This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Our radio show is heard on Pacifica stations nationwide, and our TV show can be viewed on Free Speech TV and on our website. Among the refugees impacted by Donald Trump's Muslim ban are Rohingya Muslims from Myanmar. The Rohingya are a severely persecuted minority in the nation once known as Burma. Advocates point to a well-documented extermination campaign against a people perceived as belonging to neighboring Bangladesh. But Bangladesh has also pushed the Rohingya out, and tens of thousands have fled to nations like Indonesia. Recently, a renewed campaign against Rohingya was apparently prompted by the actions of a militant faction of the minority group. Reuters reported that about 1,000 people may have been killed by Myanmar's security forces in retaliation. And Human Rights Watch released a disturbing report of the use of systematic rape against Rohingya women as a weapon of war. The genocide of Rohingya Muslims remains one of the most widely ignored in the world. My guest is Simon Billanus. He is the executive director of the International Campaign for the Rohingya. Welcome to the show, Simon.
Welcome, Sonali.
So first, let's begin with a little bit of background for those people who haven't heard about this, even though we've covered it on our program quite a bit. It just doesn't get enough mainstream media attention in the United States in particular. How is it that this minority group in Myanmar, which has had its own set of problems over the past decade, are so persecuted, so hated that Buddhist monks, people that we might imagine would never be considered, you know, fundamentalist or violence, Buddhist monks are part of the campaign of persecution and extermination?
Well, the Rohingya are indeed one of the most persecuted ethnic minorities in the world. They're not just an ethnic minority in Burma, they're also a religious minority, since they're a majority Muslim in a predominantly Buddhist country. And they've also been the target of what I could only call ultra-nationalist and extremist groups that have backed the military in Burma. And so you see a number of these ultra-nationalist groups like Mabatha, who, you know, take on the guise of being Buddhist monks or part of the Buddhist faith, and have used the Rohingya and their persecution of the Rohingya as a distraction from the overall repression by the Burmese military, and as a way of trying to get some measure of public support for the military in Burma.
So how did this latest round of violence against the Rohingya begin? I mentioned there was an incident that a militant faction of the people identifying as Rohingya attacked some Myanmar security forces, and then Reuters reported about 1,000 people may have been killed in retaliation. That happened, I believe, in December. Is that essentially what has started this latest round of what seems targeted persecution once more of this minority group?
Well, actually, you know, ironically enough, the Rohingya, even though they're one of the most persecuted minorities in Burma, have also been the group and the people least likely to pick up arms and fight the government. Now, there was an incident in October where a couple of military outposts were attacked by groups who claimed to be Rohingya, and the army then used that as an excuse and a justification for a massive crackdown and to mete out collective punishment against Rohingya communities all across Rakhine State.
And then the aid ships that are attempting to bring very needed aid to this minority are also being held back. First of all, it's very hard to even get aid for this community because of the fact that it's persecuted. But I understand that the Malaysian government has been, or the Malaysian communities and solidarity activists in Malaysia have been working hard to get aid to the Rohingya, but that aid ship was prevented from for days or for at least several hours from actually delivering the aid.
That's correct. That's correct. And to put this in context, the Burmese government and the Burmese army has restricted not just humanitarian assistance and humanitarian groups from going into Rakhine State to assist the Rohingya. They've also restricted the press and restricted human rights observers and human rights organizations. And so, it's hard to get information out of Rakhine State, particularly around the most recent crackdown. And we're relying on accounts from refugees, for instance, who fled their way to Bangladesh, and also smuggled video and other smuggled accounts that have come out of the region. But yes, there's been this a number of ships from Malaysia. Private groups have raised money for food and for medicine. They've tried to get access to the Rohingya, and the Burmese government has thrown up all manner of obstacles to their access to these Rohingya communities.
Now, the groups that are attempting to help them in Malaysia, are they able to even host Rohingya refugees? I mentioned Indonesia has taken in some refugees, and the US has actually accepted some refugees. But where else in the world can this minority flee to?
Well, these are essentially stateless people. Even though they've lived for many generations in Rakhine State in Burma, the Burmese government doesn't recognize them as citizens and has revoked not just their citizenship but also their identification, and refused to even recognize them under the name that they prefer, which is Rohingya. And so refugees, we saw in we saw in 2015 an exodus of Rohingya on boats who made their way to Thailand, to Malaysia, to Indonesia. We've also seen a lot of Rohingya flee to neighboring Bangladesh, where again, the Bangladesh government doesn't recognize them as citizens and has even proposed moving over 500,000 refugees to a waterlogged an island off the coast of Bangladesh. We're talking about a group of people who are, are unwelcome, throughout the world. Yes, the Malaysia and Indonesia have been more accepting of Rohingya refugees. And yes, and then we did have the news just recently that a group of Rohingya refugees from Indonesia are going to be resettled here in the United States, under an agreement that was made many, many months ago.
Now, in late January of this year, there was a prominent lawyer, Yu Ko Nee, who was assassinated. What role did he play in the fight to protect the Rohingya? And what does his assassination that actually happened at Yangon International Airport mean?
Yeah, Yu Ko Nee was a prominent Muslim lawyer, human rights lawyer. He had been a major voice trying to counter religious discrimination and hate speech. And also, he was a constitutional lawyer. You know, he was an advisor to the ruling party, the National League for Democracy, which is led by Aung San Suu Kyi. And he's been advising the National League for Democracy on how to change the Burmese constitution that was written by the military and enshrines a lot of privileges to the military, including 25% of the seats in parliament and also a number of key ministries, including defense, border control, and also home affairs, which oversees the police. So, you know, right now, under the constitution that was written by the military remains sort of a government, you know, of its own within the government, and is largely exempt from any kind of citizen oversight or control.
Let's talk about the Human Rights Watch report, Simon. And we've seen this in, incident after incident around the world historically. Whenever you have an extermination campaign against a particular community, women are victimized through the use of systematic rape. And sadly, in the case of Rohingya Muslim women, this is no exception. The report by Human Rights Watch, just released in early February, entitled Security Forces Rape Rohingya Women, Girls, is based on eyewitness accounts. Does this surprise you? Is this a new aspect to this conflict, or has this happened before?
I mean, this is nothing new. This is all that the Burmese army knows how to do. Mm-hmm. For decades, the Burmese army has terrorized and inflicted violence on communities of ethnic minorities who have been battling the central government. And so, you know, we've not just seen violence and rape against women. We've also seen villages burned down. We've seen people detained and disappeared. All of these tactics, all of these punishments that the army metes out against communities, we've been seeing them now since the attack in October on the military outposts in Rakhine State, and seen that meted out against the Rohingya communities. But also, we've seen this in Shan State, in Kachin State, up in the north, throughout the country. This is all that the Burmese army knows how to do.
The report by Human Rights Watch said the sexual violence did not appear to be random or opportunistic, but part of a coordinated and systematic against Rohingya, in part because of their ethnicity and religion. Many women told Human Rights Watch that soldiers threatened or insulted them with language focused on their status as Rohingya Muslims. I won't even repeat some of the words because they're just so appalling. They were basically told, "We will kill you because you are Muslim." One woman in her 20s said that soldiers attempted to rape her in her home and told her, "You are just raising your kids to kill us, so we will kill your kids." I mean, Simon, I just imagine if we replaced the signs that people in Burma are holding up, "No Rohingya," if we replace the word Rohingya with, say, Jews, we would be absolutely horrified. I mean, you know, we've said we'll never let the Holocaust happen again, yet, of course, we've had genocides since then. We've had, you know, Rwanda, and now it seems as though we have this crisis, and we don't learn our lesson till it's too late for tens of thousands of people.
Yeah, and this is exactly why the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, in their report, they highlighted all the advanced signs of genocide and pointed to the Rohingya in Burma on how the Burmese army has essentially ticked off, you know, almost all of the check boxes of an impending genocide. And so, yeah, I mean, right now the Rohingya in Burma are one of the peoples in the world most at risk of a potential genocide. And, you know, it really highlights, you know, what we need to do in the international community, and particularly here in the United States, to put effective pressure back on the Burmese army to prevent them from committing this genocide.
Well, Simon, today Muslims the world over, well, I should say the Muslims in the West are considered by the West, of course, to be part of this religion that is widely demonized. Does that play against the Rohingya, that because they are Muslim, the victimization that they face is getting less attention than if they were any other religion?
It does make it harder with some aspects and some people in the West. But I've been very encouraged by how not just the Muslim community here in the United States, but also the Jewish community, Catholics, people of no specific faith whatsoever, have come together around highlighting the Rohingya as one of the peoples in the world today where we most need to prevent a potential genocide, but also we need to counter the current wave of violence and repression. And we're seeing already that a lot of the foreign investment that Burma's government needs and desperately wants is at risk, because companies are realizing, foreign companies are realizing that investing in Burma runs the risk of being associated with this repression and also a potential genocide.
And so can Americans here who want to see this campaign of extermination and persecution end, what can they do that to pressure the U.S. government to do the right thing, to use its diplomatic and financial leverage over the Myanmar government? Of course, accepting that the U.S. doesn't usually use that sort of pressure in the most constructive of ways, but how can people pressure the U.S. government to do the right thing when it comes to Myanmar and its treatment of Rohingya?
And we've been fortunate in, up till now that we've been working with people in the U.S. government and also Congress to put pressure on Burma to end this violence and repression against the Rohingya. And that can continue. We're working right now to find new ways in which the administration and Congress can do that. We're also putting direct pressure on Chevron. Chevron is the U.S. company with traditionally the largest investments in Burma. Chevron was instrumental in getting U.S. sanctions largely dropped on Burma and on particularly on the Burmese army, giving us more limited tools to put pressure on the regime. I've been working with a group of shareholders in Chevron who've filed a shareholder resolution to come up for a vote at its annual shareholder meeting, asking the company to adopt a policy of not doing business with regimes engaged in genocide or crimes against humanity. And that's part of growing pressure on companies, particularly in the resource extraction center, oil, gas, mining companies, timber, who have direct dealings, not just with the government, but also with a lot of military-owned companies that dominate the economy.
Simon, give out a website for your organization, the International Campaign for the Rohingya.
Yep, to simply go to rohingyacampaign.org. You can get on our list and find out how you can put effective pressure on Chevron. You can put effective pressure on coming up on jewelry companies not to buy gems from Burma. Again, another trade that's dominated by the Burmese army. And this is a way of putting direct political pressure and economic pressure on the Burmese army to stop this repression and prevent this genocide.
That's rohingyacampaign.org. We'll post a link to, from our website later today. Simon, thanks so much.
Thank you very much for your time.
Simon Billinus is the executive director of the International Campaign for the Rohingya. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. We're also on Facebook at facebook.com/RU with Sonali.